Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump wants his hardline immigration policies to get even tougher.
The president has said before he does not like that. It's a horrible practice. But Congress has a way to fix that so that it will not be a magnet for people to come here and use children to do it.
Israelis vote today in a tight election pitting hardline Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and a centrist former chief of staff. Also ahead, news on efforts to fight wildlife poaching in Africa. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump is gearing up for an even more hardline immigration policy as he moves to replace his Homeland Security Secretary with someone his administration views as even more tough to deal with the crisis at the border. U.S. officials say the immigration crisis has worsened in recent weeks, and Trump has expressed increasing frustration over the number of Central American families crossing the southern border. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has this report.
Despite the Trump administration's hardline policies, migrants fleeing poverty and crime in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras continue to travel through Mexico to try to enter the United States. In February alone, some 76,000 individuals, mostly families, were apprehended on the southwest border. President Donald Trump, who campaigned on bolstering border security, was apparently increasingly frustrated with Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and fired her Sunday. Nielsen spoke briefly Monday.
I share the president's goal of securing the border. I will continue to support all efforts to address the humanitarian and security crisis on the border.
Trump announced current U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan as the acting official to replace Nielsen and appears to be gearing up for an even more hardline stance on immigration. On Monday, the White House did not rule out that Trump is considering reinstating a policy of separating migrant children from their families at the border.
The separation of families, you know, the president has said before, he does not like that. It's a horrible practice. But Congress has a way to fix that so that it will not be a magnet for people to come here and use children to do it.
Family separation was implemented from April to June of last year and was overturned in a court decision. It faced massive public outrage and did not reduce the number of migrants.
In fact, more individuals were coming here. So I think it's the administration trying to find ways to deter these individuals. But the problem is deterrence doesn't address the conditions in sending countries, for instance. It won't address the violence, it won't address the poverty, and it won't address the fact that a lot of these individuals just simply see no other option.
Trump continues to blame opposition Democrats who are challenging his national emergency declaration at the border.
Unfortunately, Democrats have refused to close immigration loopholes. That's really what it's all about.
Last Thursday, Trump backtracked on his threat to close the southern border and praised Mexico for doing more to stop the flow of migrants. But by the end of the week, he was directing aides to take tougher steps to address the problem and is reportedly considering firing more people. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A suicide blast kills three U.S. soldiers and a contractor in Afghanistan. The U.S. designates the elite Iranian force as a terrorist organization. The U.S. foils an alleged plot to drive a stolen truck into pedestrians in the state of Maryland. And Ugandan forces free a kidnapped American tourist and her driver. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israelis go to the polls today in a close election between hardline Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and centrist former Chief of Staff Benny Gantz. Neither candidate is expected to win an outright majority and will have to form a governing coalition. The election is being seen as a referendum on Netanyahu. For VOA, Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Benny Gantz towers above everyone around him as he strides into the hall for a rally for his blue and white party, promising victory.
I intend to become a Jerusalemite. Watch out.
While Gantz's supporters are enthusiastic, the latest polls show Gantz's party neck and neck with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud. Netanyahu has campaigned on his experience and his close ties with world leaders, especially President Donald Trump.
Israel has been blessed to have many friends who sat in the Oval Office. But Israel has never had a better friend than you.
Visiting the White House recently, Netanyahu praised Trump's decision to leave the Iran nuclear deal and his other moves favoring Israel. Jerusalem Post columnist Gershon Baskin says most Israeli elections have been about a potential peace deal with the Palestinians, but not this time.
Well, I think we have to realize that there has not been a peace process for many years now. Since 2009, there have been no negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the issue of peace is off the agenda within the Israeli context. The Israeli public has bought into the narrative that there is no partner for peace on the Palestinian side, and therefore it's not even an issue.
Some of Gantz's militant campaign ads boast about the number of Palestinians killed in Gaza while he was chief of staff, refuting Netanyahu's charges that he is a weak leftist. Palestinians see little hope in this election, according to Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikaki.
On the one hand, there seems to be a faint hope of change, but somehow most Palestinians seem to think that at the end of the day, it will all be the same. It doesn't matter whether you are from the right or the center or the left.
Although Gantz continues to gain support in the extremely polarized Israeli electorate, this is not enough to win, according to newspaper editor David Horovitz.
People think if you get more seats than the other party, you win an election, not in Israel, because there's multi-party coalitions, and therefore it's who can build a coalition who wins the election, and it's not looking like Gantz and Lapid and this blue and white alliance are going to be able to do that.
The Netanyahu campaign aims to convince the public that only he has the political experience and strength to lead Israel as he has for the last 12 years. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Myanmar's military said Friday that six Rohingya Muslims were killed and nine wounded in an aerial attack in the western state of Rakhine this week, and they were affiliated with an armed rebel group. The army-run Mayawati newspaper said the villagers were together with terrorists when the army was cracking down on the Iraqi army's terrorist activities Wednesday. Ravina Shamdasani, a spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman that new information on the attack has now become available.
We had issued a report on Friday saying that we understand that at least seven Rohingya Muslims had been killed in a helicopter attack by the Tatmadaw, the military of Myanmar. We are now receiving reports that the number may be much higher than that. We have unconfirmed reports that the number may be even as high as 30 who are unaccounted for. In response, we understand that a military spokesperson has said that these were terrorists who were supporting the Arakan army. We reject that accusation, and we ask the government of Myanmar and the Tatmadaw to ensure that civilians are not targeted and that heavy artillery is not used in civilian areas on the pretext of national security. We are calling on both sides to cease hostilities and to respect international human rights and international humanitarian law. The Tatmadaw, the army of Myanmar, has reacted to the attacks by the Arakan army with excessive force. We are now seeing, since the 3rd of April, the use of helicopters in civilian areas. The Arakan army, on their part, we understand that the fighting has now moved from the hills where it had begun down to the urban areas, and residential areas are being used by the Arakan army, putting civilians' lives at risk. We've also heard that the Arakan army has been targeting public administration officials and police, and that there have been targeted killings even. So we're calling on both sides to, first of all, cease the hostilities, and if hostilities are carried out, to spare civilians, to ensure the protection of civilians.
Why has there been such a resurgence in violence after so many people, so many Rohingya, were forced to cross into Bangladesh?
So what's very important is to ensure that people understand the distinction between this, the Arakan army, and the Rohingya issue. This Arakan army was established 10 years ago, and their objective was to create a state of their own, a Buddhist ethnic Rakhine state. This is a completely distinct group from the Rohingya Muslims. So this is actually completely unrelated to the exodus of the Rohingya Muslims. It's very important to have that distinction because there's often a misunderstanding that this Arakan army is composed of Rohingya Muslims when it couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, there has been a lot of reports of the Arakan army as well targeting the Rohingya Muslims. The resurgence, there was an attack in January by the Arakan army against several police border posts the government of Myanmar. The Tatmadaw, which is the army of Myanmar, then responded with strong force and received orders from the government of Myanmar to crush the Arakan army. This led to a resurgence in clashes, which has only increased in recent weeks.
So what in reality can you do, can the UN do, besides to plea for an end to the violence?
We do not have access, unfortunately, to Myanmar, in spite of repeated requests. But what is important is that we're putting the news out there. Even if we do not have access, the fact that civilians are suffering, the fact that civilians are dying, should not simply go unnoticed. We need to raise international attention and international concern on this. We need to assure the government of Myanmar, the Tatmadaw, and the Arakan army that the international community is watching and is willing and keen to hold accountable the perpetrators of this violence against civilians. The people must not be allowed to suffer in silence.
What is it about Myanmar that even a leader like Aung San Suu Kyi can't seem to lead her country to peace?
Unfortunately, we have found that the leadership in Myanmar has failed in an abominable way. There has been, far from an attempt to actually address the violations that have taken place, the very serious human rights violations that have taken place, there is often a blanket denial that anything is wrong. Even when 1 million Rohingya Muslims fled the country, there was a denial of the systematic discrimination, the institutionalized discrimination, and the violence that they had been facing over decades. Even now, there seems to be a denial that anything is wrong. The government of Myanmar is insisting that the conditions are there for the Rohingya Muslims to return to the country. This is completely untrue, patently untrue. And we are very disappointed that the continued reaction of the government of Myanmar seems to be denial and a continuation of the violations and of impunity.
Shyam Dasani says the government of Myanmar must be held accountable and responsible for what it has done to its own people. With an increasing trend in major wildlife smuggling passing through Hong Kong last week's record seizure of rhino horn en route from South Africa to Malaysia, Hong Kong, Hong Kong Council member Elizabeth Kwat called on her government to step up its approach by investigating wildlife crime under the Organized and Serious Crimes Ordinance, which would allow authorities to investigate international crime syndicates rather than just seize products. And it comes as Japan is now tightening controls on ivory, which wildlife advocates say is a first step toward a historic sales ban. Joining us to talk about this is Peter Knights, CEO of WildAid, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to end illegal wildlife trade. So thank you for being with us. Can you explain to us the steps Japan has taken and why it's significant?
What's happened is most of that ivory, between 1975 and 1989, we basically lost half of Africa's elephants to a legal ivory trade, which was actually being used to launder ivory from poached elephants. And the primary consumer of that ivory was Japan, which was going through something of an economic boom at the time. And people were sort of buying ivory tusks almost like someone might buy a gold bar, kind of a hedge against inflation, a sort of non-cash asset to hold. And so Japan accumulated this vast amounts of ivory, which all came in with legal paperwork, even though a lot of it, probably at least half of it, was coming from poached elephants. There was a kind of laundering operation going on. Now the Japanese government is trying to get a handle on where that ivory is now. So they had a registration scheme, which was open-ended with no end to it. And they only managed to register or account for about 25% of that ivory. That means that the ivory hadn't been sold legally, it hadn't been registered, but it was just sitting in people's houses. And of course, this was back in the 70s. A lot of the people that purchased that ivory are not even alive today. So in some cases, people have inherited this ivory. Mm. They don't really know what to do with it. Mm. They don't necessarily want to register it in case it came in illegally. Mm. They're just sitting on it. So the registration scheme was open-ended. It only netted about a quarter of the ivory that was out there. So finally, the Japanese government has now decided to end the open-ended registration scheme. And that's the announcement they've made. So after that, in the future, up to that time, anyone could go and just get any ivory registered. Now they're saying if you're going to register after that date, you're going to have to have it carbon dated and prove, you know, it was legally acquired. Most people won't have paperwork, you know, receipts from 40 years ago. But it is, as I think the minister alluded to, it's the natural next step in actually closing down the sales altogether. So the logical progression from this would be end the registration period, then allow a sell-off period for people who've got that legally registered ivory to actually sell it. And then after that, to have a complete sales ban, which would mean Japan would then join the rest of the world, China, United States, most of the primary countries. And basically, that would effectively be the end of the major legal ivory market.
Japan is the only major remaining legal market for ivory?
It's the only major one. There's some small players in, you know, mm-hmm. Cambodia and things like that. But the only major one mm-hmm. is Japan. The demand for ivory in Japan is very low right now compared to historical times. But obviously, the concern is if the price and the demand picks up, then that whole thing could take off again. Some of this ivory could enter markets like China. We've seen some evidence of ivory moving from Japan to China. And what I think the rest of the world community would like is for Japan to join them in this global sales ban. It's pretty much there, except for Japan.
Where does the demand stand worldwide, given that it is now illegal in most places around the world? Yep. Why is it still something that continues mm-hmm. to happen anyway?
There's still definitely some demand there, and there are people who are prepared to break the law in order to get their ivory. What we're seeing primarily with China's home market closing down, people are switching to social media. So you're not seeing ivory on sale in shops anymore in China, but people are doing it through things like WeChat. They are also going to countries like Laos and Vietnam, where law enforcement is a bit laxer, and they're buying ivory and smuggling it back into China. So we're looking at those secondary and markets and things like that. Obviously, while you still have a legal market on there, the prospect of legal sales down the line is still there. But if Japan was to close and join the world community, we'd expect to see a further dip in the ivory price.
And I understand there was just a conviction for the poaching of rhino in South Africa. Mm-hmm. How could that maybe impact mm-hmm. ending further illegal poaching for all species?
There are several aspects to how you deter and stop wildlife crime. And one of them is to reduce the price and the demand, the profitability, which we've been doing a lot of work on. The other is to have effective deterrence of the criminal elements that are involved in the smuggling. So it's a cost-risk analysis. And if the benefit is less because the price is down and the chance of apprehension is high, then that's going to help reduce the demand and reduce the people that are prepared to supply. And what we've seen historically around the world is wildlife crime has been treated, frankly, as a bit of a joke. There's been sometimes fines, usually only people, the products are confiscated, no one's prosecuted for supplying or the demand side. And so it's very important that people involved in the trade, who are basically professional criminals, do actually see some justice. And in South Africa in particular, a lot of the cases have dragged on for years and years with people having bail and not getting prosecuted, sometimes more than a decade. And so it's been good to see this latest case where three rhino poachers who were involved in a scheme where they were using tranquilizer darts to kill the rhinos, well, not to kill the rhinos, but to sedate the rhinos. There was no gunshot to be found. They would then hack the face off the rhino, and the rhino would wake up half dead with its face hacked off in the morning. Really horrific. But those people have actually now been given a 25-year sentence. So finally, some real deterrence against this crime. And that's what we need generally across the board for wildlife crime. It needs to be treated as a serious organized crime as opposed to a slap on the wrist and a fine. We think effectively it's to try and stop wildlife trade, it's a 1-2 punch. And one is effective enforcement at the one end to deter illegal acquisition and smuggling. And at the other end, it's to reduce the demand so that the profitability goes down. And if you have to try and squeeze it at both ends, and, you know, we won't necessarily eliminate all ivory poaching, for example, but if we can get it down below a certain number, then the elephant population can still expand as opposed to contract.
All right, that's Peter Knight, CEO of Wild Aid, a nonprofit organization with the mission of ending illegal wildlife trade. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On our voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangishaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, at the box office this weekend, several movies were big hits, including a superhero comedy and a true story drama.
They say you represent a great many people in this town.
Ain't me right about that.
I'm holding a committee meeting. The council will vote to either adopt or reject school immigration. I need two co-chairs, you and Ann Atwater.
Ann Atwater. I'm the president of the Klan.
He's about to hand you the keys to school integration, and you're going to lock the door.
You did.
Well, joining us now, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Well, Jeff, Best of Enemies, starring Taraji P. Henson as a civil rights activist and Sam Rockwell as a Ku Klux Klan leader, opened with 4.5 million in ticket sales. This one sounds intriguing. Tell us about it. So, Jeff, I hear we've got a new social justice movie called The Best of Enemies. What can you tell us about it?
Well, it stars Taraji P. Henson. This is based on the true story of Taraji P. Henson plays Ann Atwater, and she was a community organizer and civil rights activist in Durham, North Carolina in 1971. And Sam Rockwell stars as C.P. Ellis, who's the leader of the local Klan. These are the two people you would think would never, ever meet or talk to each other, let alone get together and work out integration in Durham, North Carolina's school system. And it seems that back in 1971, the all-black elementary school had an electrical problem and caught fire. So now these children need a school to go to. And this is on the very end of integration. You know, so most of Durham had been integrated with restaurants and parks and everything, but the last bastion of non-integration was the school. So the leader of the Klan and the leader of the black community, Ann Atwater, they had to get together for a school summit. And not only that, they had to elect black members of the community and also the white members of the community to figure out all these different solutions on where to put the children and to integrate the school system. This is a true story. And what happened was, even these two were so diametrically opposed to each other in philosophy and everything else, it was about how here the head of the Klan started to have a change of heart, started to see people as who they are after a lifetime of being in the Klan and have been indoctrinated and brainwashed. And this is a true story. And not only did they come to some amazing agreement that put integration into Durham, North Carolina school system, but also they remained friends for the rest of their lives. So this was also based on a 2015 documentary called The Best of Enemies with actual footage of C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater. And so Taraji P. Henson is a powerhouse in this movie. You think she was incredible and unrecognizable in Hidden Figures? Wait till you see her in this. She explodes on the screen with such passion and with such drive. And then Sam Rockwell playing the leader of the Klan, here we saw him last year in Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, where he was a racist cop who also had a change of heart by changing, by listening, and by becoming a better person. So Best of Enemies, incredible drama. It's one of my favorite films of the year so far.
Wow, that's quite an endorsement. All right, we'll definitely have to check that one out. And then we've got a good old-fashioned superhero movie, sounds like. Shazam.
That's right, and we're not talking Gomer Pyle either.
Right.
Now, when I was a kid, I was like at the golden age of live Saturday morning television, you know, Sigmund and the Sea Monsters and Jason of Star Command. And, of course, one of my favorites was Shazam. And it's about the story of a teenager, Billy Batson, who's instilled with the powers of these celestial elders. When he invokes the name Shazam, he inherits those powers to do good against evil. Now, when that kid show I watched on Saturday morning when I was about Shazam, when he became Shazam, he was a mature adult. And what's great about this movie is that when he turns into Shazam, he is still the 14-year-old boy.
So it's like Big meets Superman. That's it. And this is all in the DC universe. So Zachary Levi, who plays Shazam, is just, he steals every scene he's in. He's charging people's cell phones in the hallway at school. He's, you know, stopping convenience store robberies. He and his best friend are trying to figure out all his superpowers. They have a checklist. Can you fly? Can you stop bullets? Can you use lasers out of your eyes? And then, of course, we have Mark Strong, who plays our villain, who was bullied a lot as a child. He rises to the point where he wants to get Shazam's powers and use them for evil. So this is hysterical. It's funny. It's a winner from DC. We'll put it in the column along with Wonder Woman and Aquaman. And it's really fun. It really is. I think people are going to have a good time with this, and we're going to have a good franchise from this movie.
All right. That's Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, if you're a fan of Peter Gabriel, you probably know his popular hits like Sledgehammer and Big Time. But even the most rabid of fans might not know that Gabriel actually recorded music for the 2012 political drama The Reluctant Fundamentalist, or that he put a song in the 2017 animated film Birds Like Us. And for fans, those fans, a reminder to everyone else, comes a collection of 10 songs on a compilation that he has supplied four films. Each tune on the album, titled Rated PG, is married to its movie, from dark dramas to cute animated movies, all spanning decades. Some of the songs are well known, others are welcome reminders of some forgotten gems. Rated PG also resurrects lost tracks from that outshined their films. You could have a big dipper, going up and down, all around the bends. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Cause I will be your home.
This is VOA.